Blog Talk Radio.
Production of The Speculist. You can find us online at speculist.com. That's speculist.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we're all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which lie at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict and sometimes hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and will be here sooner than you think. My name is Stephen Gordon, and here with me in the Fast Forward Radio virtual studio is special guest PJ Manny. She's actually more of a guest host, aren't you, PJ? Welcome.
I am. Thank you very much, because our dear Phil is a little busy right now.
That's right. We announced last week that Phil is the new dad of twins. He's a new dad again, and so he promised his dear sweet wife that he would he'd lay off the podcasting for a couple of weeks. You know, we're gonna just give him a pass on that. He's done it about like 100 weeks in a row, so I think we can kind of give him a pass on that, and so we can continue to congratulate him, and we will welcome him back, I believe, next week. I think he plans to rejoin us next week. So that'll be exciting, too. So what we wanted to get into tonight was this subject, and this is kind of a surprising subject for a lot of people. Here it is. We are living in awesome times. And so, you know, PJ, I don't know about you, but when I turn on the news, I'm not hearing that message at all. So
not at all. And not at all, Stephen.
Absolutely. So, I wonder if I've bitten off more than I can chew here. What do you think?
No, I don't think so, because with the disturbing or the upsetting or the just plain old sad, always comes some wonderful things. And let's face it, the news business isn't based on happy stories. So I wouldn't pay too much attention to what the media feeds you, because the media is looking for the almighty dollar. And the worse the story, the more the eyeballs.
Well, there's the old saying, if it bleeds, it leads, right?
Exactly. So, I mean, right.
Bad news, you know, regardless of, you know, what party's in office, you know, you're going to hear bad news about the candidate that's in office. You're going to hear bad news about this and that. And the world's always about to come to an end because people find that kind of news interesting. And you know, I would say we do have some difficult challenges, and I'm not trying to play that down at all. I think that we've got some tough stuff ahead, but we also have a lot of things going for us that most people aren't thinking about. And I would say that, well, I'm going to just go ahead and get started with a couple. I think just to start throwing it out might be a good idea. Actually, let me just throw this one out to you, PJ. You were looking at personal genomics. Tell me a little bit about that and why you think that's going to be important going forward.
Well, it's actually been a very interesting issue, because when we decoded the human genome, and when we actually haven't made a lot of big strides that people recognize since this enormous thing of completing an entire human genome. And now we've done it many times. And there are many people right now who we have their entire genome on record. But the big promise was this notion of personal genomics, that if my DNA is different than your DNA, that maybe our medicine, how we're treated for diseases, needs to be different as well. That not only may I have different diseases than you, but even if we have what's technically the same disease, a drug that works for me may not work for you, and vice versa. So we're chipping away at this enormous concept of personal genomics. And the story which really touched me this week, where this is actually a pretty major concept that they're just starting to get a grip on, is the notion that if we have mutations that cause disease, we can now find where these mutations are in our genome. But what is the effect on different people based on if they have one allele that is mutated or if they have two alleles that are mutated? And in this particular case is the Beery family of Texas, who they have two small children who first were, I believe, diagnosed with cystic fibrosis, then they were diagnosed with, cerebral palsy, then they were diagnosed with a number of different things. Nothing seemed right. And it's one of these cases where it was so fortuitous that the right patient and the right parents met the right doctors at the right institution. One of the parents happens to work in personal genomics, and the mother was dogged in her determination to figure out exactly what was wrong with her children. They went to Baylor College of Medicine. They discovered that these children have this, very rare disease. They were able to locate the fact that the children have two mutated alleles because each of the parents has one. Now, in the parents, it manifests in relatively common, not terribly serious diseases like fibromyalgia. But in the children, it manifests in extremely serious nerve disorders and potentially fatal. What was interesting was one of the doctors, Dr. James Lupsky, who's, I think, the vice chair of molecular and human genetics at Baylor, he himself is a patient with a similar situation where his parents had one mutated allele, and he suffers from a disease of two mutated alleles. And he, therefore, had an amazing interest in this kind of science and was able to discover what these children had, and therefore, because they know exactly what genes are involved, what drugs would cure them. And the children are doing very well. So this is a case, I think, where we're really at the very beginning of personal genomic medicine, where when we can break down exactly at the genetic level what's wrong, we may be able to fix it very specifically. But even more interesting was the accidental discovery, which was many of these common diseases that people have are a single allele disease. It's the double allele disease that can be devastating on this very same gene.
Okay, so and so it might be that, there are a lot of people out there that might carry the mutation and not have the disease because they only have the single allele.
Or what they have is something that, is not life-threatening, is inconvenient, can affect their quality of life, but ultimately isn't going to kill them. It's the double whammy of the same alleles that could be a fatal disease.
Well,
and a completely different disease, which is so interesting.
There was a TED Talk, PJ, that was published here just recently. It was Daniel Kraft, Dr. Daniel Kraft, who gave this TED Talk, and he talked about everything that excites him in medicine that's going on right now. And, I mean, he covered a lot of ground. One of the things he mentioned was that, when the Human Genome Project basically was a $1 billion project, that's what it cost to sequence the first DNA, first human DNA, but that price is being cut in half, on an annual basis just about. And what he is predicting is that in just a couple of years, we're going to be looking at about $100 genome. And when that happens, then everybody will have that information. He says, now, the problem is that these things are advancing faster than our doctors are accepting that into their practice. And I saw another story about that. Basically, right now, we've got genetic tests. In this particular story, it pointed out that we've got 1,200 genetic tests that are available to doctors that are approved for use. And it tests for over 1,000 different genetic diseases, but that only 13% of doctors had ordered a genetic test in the last 6 months. So what that's telling me is that they're being presented with, you know, with cases, sick people in front of them, and more likely than not, they're just they'll treat the symptoms more often than order a genetic test. Maybe because wasn't part of what they were taught in med school, or whatever. It's not being accepted into the practice as fast as it's becoming available to doctors to have. So,
Worries me that we're approaching something where we're going to start having more and more of this. It's going to become faster and faster, as we've discussed.
Right.
How are doctors going to be able to keep up with all of these new tests, all of these new findings? You're going to have specific doctors, a handful of doctors who may actually know what they're doing in what's a relatively large field, but the vast majority of gatekeeper general practitioners, I don't know how they're going to catch up.
Well, I think that we're going to be depending more and more on AI. I just have to believe that we're going to have to do more of that. Basically it's, all these doctors are going to be walking around with iPads or things like it, and, here are the symptoms I'm seeing, any recommendations. The system comes back with, with the recommendation for maybe this test or that test. They run the test. If it goes a certain way, then maybe there's a recommended treatment. I mentioned that Watson, that system that beat the guys on Jeopardy, is now being taught medicine. And, I would expect that things like that, maybe not that system specifically, but systems like that are going to become a big part of medicine because human doctors are just not going to be able to keep up.
Right, so every doctor will have a Watson.
That's right. Just walking around with a Watson in their pocket, an iPad that serves as Watson, So I think, that's got to be a big part of it. And, that is actually something to be excited about because, I don't know about you, PJ, but if you ever spend any time in a hospital, with anything that's approaching just a little bit unusual, you sometimes get the idea that these guys don't know anything more about what's going on with you than you do.
Absolutely. Yeah. I have a personal vested interest in seeing not just Watson, but genomic medicine happen, because while I'm generally healthy, because I have, I've had three doctors in my life call me an anomaly, and we think it's a combination of my redheaded genes, which the more we learn about redheads, the more we realize we're practically a different species from the rest of you. My Ashkenazi genes, which is a whole other group of inbred genetic coding for a relatively small group of people in the world. And I firmly believe, and I'm, at some point I want to really explore this, my potentially Neanderthal genes.
There's
stuff there that I've analyzed for a long time. The fact that my family is a little unusual in certain ways, and nothing wrong, just different. And when you look at sort of Neanderthal traits, you go, interesting. They have them too. So maybe our family has a higher percentage of potentially Neanderthal genes. So a combination of the redhead, the Ashkenazi, and the Neanderthal. You can't give me a medication and expect to know exactly how it's going to react on me. So virtually every medication I'm given is a complete crapshoot on reactions. And if there's that 1 in 10,000 chance something different will happen, I'm the 1 in 10,000.
Yeah, I guess somebody's got to be.
Right. But why always?
PJ is the 10,000th person. But we think you're a 1 in a million around here, PJ.
Well, thank you. But you can imagine, I'm looking forward to people being able to look at my genome and for, very simple things, be able to give me a medication that either works or won't actually harm me more than help me.
Right, right. Now, and everybody is different, if you think about it. I saw another story earlier this week saying, it might have been tied with the new X-Men movie or something, but it said basically everybody is a mutant, and here's why. And it went back to some study, showed that every single person walking around on average has 60 mutations that makes them a little bit different from every other person in the world. Most of these mutations don't amount to anything. It's just you know, just a little piece of code that's just slightly different in me than in the next person. But it and it may not amount to much different, but sometimes it does. And maybe a particular combination of mutations amounts to something and makes a person specifically different. Maybe for the better, maybe for the usually actually it's probably not all that great, mutations or not, but every now and then it's a little bit better. And so that's kind of the way nature works. It's good to know, you know, the more we know about ourselves, the better we can, be treated by doctors and things. So
absolutely.
I think that's exciting. I'm excited about companies that are getting involved in it. 23andMe is probably the biggest name so far, but there are many companies that are doing this sort of thing. So, that's going to be interesting when a doctor can, you know, have your entire genome in front of them, and not just the, you know, G, A, T, C, you know, not, you know, but something actually, but you have the information drawn out of it.
Well,
maybe
that's exactly
it. Maybe by some kind of data mining system, you know, a data mining system to look at it and say, okay, here are specific things that make this person unique, and here's how you should treat them. And that's just going to take a lot of computation, and looks like we're getting more and more of that all the time. So that's something to be excited about.
Indeed.
Yep. Well, it seems like we've got a lot of medical topics tonight. I mean, I just basically, you know, said, you know, we're living in awesome times, and then went out looking for, you know, topics, and it seems like I kind of got on a lot of medical topics. I'll throw this one out here. Miraculous new spray-on skin technology treats burns without scars. And just an incredible article there, and the pictures are really something else. It shows this little baby. It looks like about a toddler that had a foot that was just absolutely scorched. I mean, down you know, past the initial layers, and I mean, it's third-degree burns, really, really bad. And then it shows the after pictures after they had tried this experimental technology, and the baby's foot looked perfect. I mean, it was
wow. No
scarring. It was, and you can imagine how devastating it would be to have, you know, scar tissue is not the same as regular skin. You know, if the bottom of your foot is nothing but a giant scar, you're going to have problems the rest of your life. And what they were able to do for this child was just miraculous. I put there in the show notes, I put the link to that particular story. That was worth going to see just for the pictures. So, to me, that's exciting. Seeing things like that happen all the time, that's pretty incredible. So, seems like we get one of those. We get a story that's that level of exciting. Seems like every week. But
it's so true. We really do. We really do.
Yeah.
Now, for me, you know, I think one of the reasons why we're getting those every week kinds of stories is that we're actually sharing information at an extraordinary rate. And these, you know, they may seem like relatively small leaps, but they're very significant in terms of the amount of cross, I'm having one of those brain moments, having a senior moment, cross-disciplinary subjects. So here we're sharing all this information. We're sharing it with people who aren't necessarily siloed in single disciplines. And it's yielded these really remarkable results, one of which I love, is that we're kind of making a full circle. You know, back before science was a career, science was a hobby for people of the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries. And people were amateurs making these remarkable discoveries. Well, now amateurs are again making remarkable discoveries because of the internet, because of sharing of information. And some of these amateurs are even teenagers. We're seeing some of these kids going through the science fairs are presenting unbelievable new information, from discoveries in astronomy to new drug regimes. There's this one young man who I adore who figured out a new cystic fibrosis drug regime that no one had ever come up with, and it is doing remarkable things. A couple of guys who won the recent Intel Science Fair figured out a new way to fry cancer cells.
Awesome. The one that with the cystic fibrosis, I've read about him. He really had a tough time kind of breaking in.
Yes.
He was trying to get a lab that would work with him. And, you know, here he is. He's just a high schooler. And, no, we don't have time for you, kid. You know, move along. You bother me. But he kept at it. He had a dream that he could get in there and make a contribution, and he did. And he finally found someone that would let him in, and he got started and he was interested in what would happen with cystic fibrosis if a certain combination of drugs was tried, not just one drug, but a certain combination. And it turns out the combination works much better than any of the drugs working singularly. So,
but it was not a part of a traditional protocol.
Exactly. So, fresh eyes on a subject is never a bad thing. And thanks to the internet and the greater connected society we have, that's a big part of it. So yeah, that's exciting.
So I hope that all scientists and technologists listening out there, when a kid comes to your door and says, "Hey, I'd really like to work with you. Can I help?" Open the door, please, and let them in.
Yeah. You know, I mean, he can, you know, if it turns out he's not the genius that this one kid was, he can fetch the coffee. Come on, you know. I mean,
right, exactly.
Give it a shot, you know. Nothing bad can happen from that. It's a good thing. So, anyway. That's an awesome story. I love that. I love that it's allowing people that have an interest in something, perhaps because, you know, maybe a family member is sick with a certain disease or something. Maybe they get out there and they read everything in the world on it, and they have more of a vested interest maybe than their local doctor. And they may have an idea or maybe they can find a treatment or a trial that they can get their loved one in. That kind of thing happens all the time. So.
Exactly.
It's exciting. That's an exciting time here. Okay, I'm going to just move from medicine just real quick. We'll probably end up back at medicine at some point before the show's out. But I wanted to bring this one up. Cold fusion, a cold subject, right? It's dead, it's done, it's been, you know, discredited, right? Well, actually, we've got this particular process of low-energy nuclear, is what they're calling it now, instead of cold fusion. It's low energy nuclear. has been replicated. Yeah, sometimes you just have to have a new name, right?
That's right.
The old name,
rebranded.
The old name is so branded and so, you know, nobody will touch it that they had to change it. It's low energy nuclear now. This particular process has been confirmed in a second laboratory. This particular scientist, Brian Ahern, is now getting 8 watts in a low-energy nuclear process. Now, 8 watts is not much, right?
I mean, no.
A 60-watt bulb, you know what, you know, that he's getting 8 watts. But it's the sort of thing that can be scaled up, and there's nothing exotic being done, or no exotic materials or anything. So a lot of folks are excited about that. So, I mean, to me, every potential thing, you know, may not work out, but hey, let's try everything and see which one does, you know. So I'm
looking forward to seeing how that goes. Yeah,
the fact that it's now in a second lab, Brian Wong said this seems to lower the possibility by a lot that anything fraudulent was going on in the first test.
Mm.
That it's been able to be duplicated in another lab. It's that helps show that a lot. Now, whether this we're ever able to scale it up into anything useful, that's a whole nother matter. But the fact that there is something going on there, that's pretty exciting. You know, I mean, a lot of physicists have kind of wondered how can anything be going on. It challenges our notions of what is going on in nuclear science. You know, traditionally, classically, it sort of challenges those ideas. But hey, I love it when our ideas are challenged. It's not a bad thing.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Okay, well, I'm going to let you. You got another one for us, PJ.
I got one. Steve Pinker, this is a few years ago, but trajectory hopefully has not stopped, discussed at a TED about this notion of the myth of modern violence. And he and a number of people have been able to look at, from the fossil record, through the archaeological record, through the modern history, that we've had a continual diminishment of violence throughout human history. That the odds of being killed in a murderous act, if you were a hunter-gatherer, were outrageously high. In some cases, up to 60%.
Yeah.
That was 60% of death.
That was why you were going to die, probably.
That was the way you were going to die, violently and probably from another tribe. That was how it was going to go. Whereas, and he sees it, I mean, he describes it almost like decelerating change, and that there's an elbow in the deceleration. And the elbow, interestingly, is the late 16th century and the 17th century and the Age of Enlightenment. And I'd be really curious as well to lay the graph of decelerating violence against the graph of accelerating technological change. I'd like to see, I know the elbows aren't exactly in the same place, but I'd be very curious to see if there's some kind of progression there, because one of the many reasons why we think, there are lots of reasons why we think we may have less violence, and so much less violence in human history now, is that technologies have aided us for a whole bunch of reasons. One is the notion that, you know, technology increases trade. We play these what are called non-zero-sum games. Robert Wright wrote an entire book called Non-Zero, The Logic of Human Destiny. I really recommend all your listeners to read the book. It's one of the great books of all time.
I agree. I've read it. It's great.
It's great.
Yeah.
And, you know, he discusses this notion of cooperation increasing because we realize that it's in our economic interest for cooperation to continue. So, you know, the classic example that Robert Wright always uses is, let's not bomb Japan because we really like their cars.
Yeah, we're gonna find some other way. If they get on our nerves, we'll just find some other way to deal with it besides bombing.
Right, exactly. And diplomacy, et cetera, exactly. So here's this notion that technology itself could be decreasing violence because we're now sharing in its benefits and we're becoming reliant on one another.
Right, right.
You know, go on.
I was just thinking, you know, the elbows are in slightly different places, but maybe we're looking at the wrong elbow. There was, I read an article recently about how the Industrial Revolution was preceded by something that sociologists are now calling the Industrious Revolution. And it's basically, it dates more from the printing press than anything else. As people became, you know, as knowledge was dispersed and people became a little more connected because, you know, maybe something as simple as flyers and things being passed out or pamphlets or you know, whatever preceded the newspaper at that point. As things like that were being passed around, that, you know, ideas were able to mix and mingle, and pretty soon you got the Industrial Revolution as a direct consequence of that. It could be that what we're talking about as far as the drop in the murder rate may date from that point.
Well, that's actually tied into another notion of the drop in the murder rate, which is, you know, increased empathy. Now, this all goes back mm-hmm. to, you know, what I always end up talking about, which is the notion that media, specifically narrative media, tells people stories about each other, and it, you know, it could be a fictional narrative, but it could also be a newspaper narrative. And, you know, once the printing press hit humanity changed because we started sharing stories in a way, common stories that had never happened before.
Right.
So this notion that people were able to share ideas, share points of view, allowed them to realize, well, maybe we don't want to kill those people over there because they're kind of like us. And they agree.
Yeah. And maybe we can be of maybe we can cooperate with one another instead. You know, this may be kind of a silly analogy, but I mean, there's a reason we don't eat horses. You know, horses are just a lot more useful to us in other ways. So, we got to a point where we just stopped using them as food, and we because they're just so much more useful in other ways. Well, our fellow human beings are no longer just the a competitor for the wildlife that we have in our woods around us. You know, that's we don't look at human beings, fellow human beings, that way anymore. We see, the man down the street. You know, maybe the guy that's going to fix my car next week, the guy that I need to call when my plumbing has a problem or something. We depend on one another, and that's a huge change from the way things were before. So. Yeah,
I think it's going to increase. You know, I actually think this is not something that's going to eventually plateau out. I do believe that communications technologies are going to increase this notion of global empathy, the fact that we care about people halfway around the world, and that it will continue to decrease the levels of violence. You know, we think a lot of our belief in that we live in a violent society is actually, ironically, a product of that media telling nothing but bad stories. But they really have to search for those stories now. You know, I don't know if you noticed, but it's fascinating watching the news or reading news online or even in the paper. My Los Angeles Times tells me bad stories from all over the country and all over the world, and like they're having to dig it up.
Yeah.
You know, it's fascinating to me that, you know, so we get this sense that, oh, there's all this violence, but in fact, it's really an illusion. There is violence, but it is so much less violent that now we're sensitive to it because it's an unusual thing. You know, in the past, people died, for the most part, pretty gruesome, awful deaths. Death was considered in a completely different light. And the notion of how someone died was considered in a completely different light. Now, people don't tend to die like that anymore.
Right.
And we look at it as that rare event that pops up in our consciousness that is suddenly the thing we have to be afraid of. You know, because that's a big problem with risk assessment and human cognition. We're really, really, really bad at risk assessment because we tend to think the most dangerous things are, in fact, the things least likely to kill us, because they're the novelty act of what we're supposed to fear. You know, if everybody realized how much more likely they were to die driving to the airport in their car than actually flying in the airplane at the airport, I think it would change a lot of people's notions of, you know, what's actually dangerous.
You know, Ken in the chat room just asked a question. He asked, will an iPhone in almost every person's hand decrease stupidity?
Amen.
I'm going to just answer that in one word, Ken. Yes. Yes, it will. I mean, it connects us. We learn from these devices. I mean, anything that, I'm sitting around I might be at the Whataburger with my kids eating a hamburger, and they have some off-the-wall question, which, of course, I don't know the answer to. When I asked off-the-wall questions when I was a kid, my parent would have looked at me and said, well, I don't know that. Go back to eating your burger, you know. But, my answer now is, well, here's my iPhone. Look it up. And the conversation keeps going. You know, they look at, oh, this is cool. Look at this. And we'll talk about, maybe something I might be able to contribute to. Yes, an iPhone in every hand does decrease stupidity. It makes us smarter. Even when we don't know anything about it, we can whip it out and learn real quick. So yes.
Well, I jokingly say that Google is the third lobe of my brain, because it is.
and the fact that you can carry that lobe in your with you now, it's not
exactly
not just when you if you're at home or at your office or something, but it's with you all the time. That's a big, huge change, isn't it? So yeah.
You know, there was a period where it was considered kind of bad manners to whip out your iPhone and look stuff up on Google and be kind of the know-it-all. I wonder if that's going to change.
I wonder if
yeah, exactly. Yeah. That everybody's whipping out their phone.
You know, you're kind of expected to be a know-it-all now. You know, I mean, if you don't know it, you ought to be able to tell me within 30 seconds. Come on, get with it, people. That's kind of the vibe I'm getting now. You know, so it's everybody kind of has an expectation of being able to get the information they need very quickly these days. Okay,
yes, exactly.
and I got another story that tells helps explain why, and this might actually hit home for you, PJ. There's a company called Sonic.net that's in California, of course. You know, it's not in flyover country where I live, but in California, that is starting a trial of 1 gigabyte per second fiber to home internet access. And what they're going to charge the people that feel like they need 1 gigabyte per second to their home is $70 a month. $70. So, that's, it's expensive, but it's not, if they offered it in my area, I would probably consider it. That's pretty awesome. So there's just another example of why we pretty much expect information immediately. So.
Well, and, the UN just this past week declared that connection to the internet is a human right.
I love that. I find that, it's not just a luxury. It's very important to people to have the information. Information is, in a way, it's a necessity like food and water in a way, because
it's a direct contradiction to how law enforcement is trying to, in certain countries, is trying to figure out, if you've been a pirate, if you've been abusing copyright. There's in some countries like France and I think New Zealand, there's a 3 strikes and you're off of the internet.
Yeah.
And the UN is saying, no, you can't tell people they can't be on it.
Yeah, that's remarkable. And, there would be some instances where I would say you might forfeit your human right if you're a person that's like a pedophile or something like that. I mean, I would at some point I would say, no, you don't get internet access anymore. If you brought down the stock exchange, 2 or 3 times, I might at some point. I might want to say we've let you do it 2 or 3 times. You've cost us billions. No more internet for you. But as a general rule, I think, everybody ought to have it. Everybody, no matter how wacky your ideas are, we put it out there in the marketplace of ideas, and let's see what cream flows to the top. And that's exciting. So both that we're getting more and more connected with faster internet connections, and now it's being considered a human right. So pretty awesome.
Yeah, all we're waiting for is the brain jack.
I think the next thing, in all seriousness, instead of an iPhone that you hold in your hand, it'll probably be something connected to glasses frames, where you see it overlaid in front of you.
Oh, absolutely, and have augmented reality, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So, yeah, cool stuff ahead in those ways. Yeah. This is sort of interesting, tell me if there's anything you think in this that we should be concerned about, PJ, but DARPA is working on something called Living Foundries, and basically it's the use of life to manufacture all kinds of materials. It could be as gasoline, it could be pharmaceuticals, it could be run-of-the-mill plastics and things like that, and they're working on these foundries at DARPA. I'm not exactly sure what the Defense Department, would be, what their specific interest in how they would apply this technology, but they do all kinds of blue sky stuff there. What's your thoughts on that? Does that make the world
well? Golly, it's a Michael Crichton novel in the making.
Yeah, it makes it interesting, anyway. Right? I think the idea of having bacteria that can manufacture our petroleum, things like that, pretty exciting to me. That would solve a lot of problems if we were able to do that. But you know, it, there's, but there, you know, Michael Crichton could certainly have come up with something that we possibly should be concerned about with all that. But at any rate, interesting stuff. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you know, for every technology, there's good uses and bad uses, and
exactly.
You know, you can't guarantee that necessarily the agenda for some of these uses. It would be very interesting to see now. Are they looking at this more for, as you said, fuel, or more for medicine, or what is their?
Let me just read you kind of the overview. The idea is to use, I'm reading here, the idea is to use biology as a manufacturing platform to enable on-demand production. Basically, I mean, you got a machine in front of you. You type in what you want, and the machine goes to work making it using, you know, biology within the machine, okay? It somehow directs it's a programmable life. To make whatever it is you punch in, I guess. Enable on-demand production of new and high-value materials, devices, and capabilities. So before we get our Eric Drexler nanofactory, we get this. It would appear that this is on closer on the horizon. And so I'll just make sure that we get the link in the chat room too.
That's interesting because actually, if I remember correctly, I'm trying to remember the name of the Crichton novel. I think it was Prey. That was actually, which was a nanoswarm story. That was actually his mechanism for nanomanufacturing. Was definitely it was a living foundry of DNA, which was actually assembling these nanostructures into nanoswarms. So good on Michael, wherever he is.
We miss you, Michael. You're a wonderful author. I'm putting the thing in the chat room right now. They were having a Living Foundries Industry Day where they're inviting all these different industries in to talk about what they're doing and perhaps get some more collaboration going with that particular project. Interesting. Let me throw this out. You have anything in particular, in general, that makes you believe we're in awesome times that we haven't covered yet, PJ?
Well, I do want to bring up one thing that I think is actually really interesting. There was back in 2007, Ray Kurzweil wrote a little piece about why he was optimistic for the future. And I thought that what I really liked was the line he started off with, you know, optimism exists on a continuum in between confidence and hope. And so many, you know, I think the DARPA the DARPA thing makes me think about, you know, the hope end of that continuum. That you know, I really hope that this kind of technology is going to be used constructively and well, and you know, successfully, with not a lot of nothing that might bite us in the rear end to worry about. You know, some of the things we talked about tonight, I think, you know, are much more on the confidence side of the continuum.
Right.
Especially a lot of the health things we've been discussing. And certainly I think also in terms of, you know, communication and empathy and things like that. But there is so much out there that I think are these wonderful developments that actually lie more on the hope side of that continuum, that, you know, you look at it and think, wow, I really hope that it, you know, nobody tries to use this in a bad way.
Right. Well, you know, we got the news a couple of weeks ago about the E. coli breakout in Europe. I believe they finally traced it and confirmed it was from some contaminated bean sprouts or something like
that. Yes, exactly.
It's a very troubling to CDC and other organizations like that, because for one thing, this bacteria is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. It's in our bodies. I mean, we're adapted to use it, actually. If a particular strain that kills us were to get around to, too quickly, then it could create a really, really big, huge problem for humanity. Okay, and so these doctors, they and disease specialists, they really watch carefully, particularly something that some mutations in E. coli that make them deadly. It's a concern. But let me just kind of give you a hopeful story that kind of might give us kind of a positive spin on this. There's a particular blight with wheat called rust that has gotten a hold of a lot of the wheat in Asia and Europe, and it's spreading throughout the world. And so what do the experts on wheat decide to do? Well, let's look at all the different wheat varieties that we have, and they bred real quickly and came up with a wheat variety that is resistant to this rust blight. And so, I mean, basically, what will end up happening is that as quickly as possible, they're distributing these seeds, and free of charge, by the way, so that the next crop will be, a crop that can't be attacked or easily by this particular rust. Now, evolution being what it is, maybe it'll adapt to this over time. But what you do is, since we've got brains, we can move, I believe, quicker than evolution can and things like this. And so we just need to get up and going with the ability to combat these things as soon as we learn about them. If we got a push button solution, here's the problem, we need to manufacture the solution. If we get good enough at that, we can almost immediately come up with a solution to the problem as soon as the problem appears. And at some point, you talk about the defense. That may be a more important part of our defense in the future, is defending us from diseases to our crops and to our bodies than anything else. So.
Well, it's really interesting.
You get really good at that.
But yeah. you made a point that I think is I'd like to clarify, because you said that we have brains and we can react more quickly than evolution. But don't forget, we're now in the Anthropocene. It's no longer the Holocene. We've now it looks like we're hopefully renaming this epoch we're in the Anthropocene, because we are now the driver of evolution. So. It's a little bit of a feedback loop going on. Since we're driving evolution, will we be able to react as quickly as this ever increasing pace that we're developing?
Well, I think the only solution, PJ, is to put the pedal to the floor in developing the technology, because we need to be good enough at the technology to be able to respond when some mad scientist or some terrorist group puts out some disease. Okay, I think that's the only solution. And of course, hoping that empathy takes hold as we move further and further along, that we see fewer and fewer instances of mad scientists doing things like that. But yeah, we in order to defend against something that's man-made, we need to get good at man-making new things to begin with. So it's like you say, it's a feedback loop, but I don't think it's one we can escape. If we were to relinquish it, then we'd just become the potential victims that can have no way of defending ourselves from that kind of attack. So we're gonna have to get real good at it, and then absolutely have no patience for someone within our own ranks that would do something to hurt somebody with that kind of technology. Just be real strong in prosecuting and whatever, stopping that kind of technology if somebody were to use it in an evil way in our own midst, and of course be ready to defend if it's if it comes from somewhere else too. So, you know, what do you think about that, PJ? I mean, is there any other way to defend? But I mean, to just besides getting good at this.
Well, I think the only way we can get good at it is, frankly, to get smarter. And I mean that both in collective intelligence, the idea of, you know, of crowdsourcing this information, getting fresh eyes, we've talked about that already. But, you know, I think it's also about individual intelligence because it's crucial that people understand what really are risks and what really aren't risks. And the only way to assess that is, you know, pretty coolly and logically, but our intelligence is inextricably tied to our emotional states. And there's something to be said for the fact that we actually couldn't make any decisions if we didn't have our emotions. Antonio Damasio, the neuroscientist, talks a lot about that, that's a loop that we absolutely need. If we cease to have an emotional state, as intellectual and logical as we might be, we actually can't make decisions, that our emotions are actually what drive decision-making. But I think overall we're going to have to increase our intelligence because we have to realize what are the real threats. And we have to come, as you said, to them very quickly. I think there's a human trait of burying our heads in the sand until the absolute last minute. And another human trait of when we have very large groups, you know, that have to be governed, that basically the governors, our politicians, don't really want to make any crucial decisions until, again, they absolutely positively have to, and that might be too late. So how do we get out of this sort of this social structures that we have in place that might slow down our ability to react in a timely manner? You know, I would hope that if we could get smarter, that maybe that would speed up the process, that people would stop looking at their own personal interest, getting reelected, keeping their job, et cetera, and look at it from a more global standpoint.
Right. Well, and I'm hopeful that we'll be more proactive in facing these problems instead of burying our heads in the sand. You know, the type of work I do, I'm a personal injury lawyer primarily, but I might see a pattern where people come in and I get hired over and over for accidents that happen at a particular intersection, and there have been a couple of occasions where I've called the city council and said, look, guys, I mean, there's no light at that intersection. I happen to know of a death at this intersection and several other accidents that could have been prevented with a traffic light. How many folks got to die before you guys put it in? The couple of times I've made that call, you know, within 6 months there'd be a traffic light at that intersection. I'm hoping.
Can you come to my town and work with them?
Yeah, give them a call. There's some intersections.
Please.
Yeah. Well, anyway, there's, I'm hopeful that we don't have to have some big, huge tragedy where, you know, a lot of people die because we weren't ready for some sort of biological attack. That would, I think that we're going to, we're getting up to speed on this quickly already. I mean, we're I do have some high hopes about it. So yeah, we've got some concerns, but yes, I still think we live in awesome times. So there's that. I'm going to go quickly to the next thing real quick. 3D printing. This is about to get real, BJ, and one of the reasons why is that in order to get involved in this hobby of 3D printing, you don't need to have thousands and thousands of dollars worth of equipment anymore. You could, if you wanted to, you could go out and buy yourself a 3D printer you probably could get a halfway decent one for about $1,500 now. And 3D scanning is important too, because you want to have, you know, if you want to have something, you have something in your home you want to make another one of, you need to have a 3D scan of it. So that will cost a little bit more. But there's a whole lot more simple and economic way to get involved in the hobby now. And basically it comes down to this. There are apps now for your iPhone where you can take multiple pictures of an object and then get a 3D scan off of it that way. And then there's free software that you can edit that 3D scan on your own, on your computer, and then you upload that scan. Maybe it's altered slightly from what's in your home. Maybe you needed it slightly different or whatever. And that's why you use the editing software. You upload it then to a printing service on the internet. So that's the way a lot of this is. A lot of the hobbyists that are getting involved in 3D printing now are doing this. They're doing with stuff they already have, and it's gonna be huge. I mean, people are beginning to make their own stuff, and it's trinkets at first, but we're gonna get better and better at these things, and pretty soon we'll have embedded electronics in these printed items. So. That's exciting. This is coming a long way. First time I mentioned Fab Labs and 3D printing a couple of years back, it was pretty much the domain of rapid prototypers that, were used for major industries. But now it's getting to where just any person can get involved in it. And pretty neat. It's pretty outstanding where this is going. So exciting thing.
Just so any of your listeners think somehow that 3D printing is, very complex and the domain of adults, there's this wonderful video. I know you can find it on Boing Boing. There are probably a lot of other places. I mean, even if you just Google 3D printing kid video, there's this 10-year-old kid. I think his name is Skylar St. Ledger, who gives the most delightful 6-minute video about his MakerBot. Isn't that the most wonderful? I glowed after watching that. gave me faith that we were living in awesome times.
Absolutely. You got this kid that's up there and just regales the whole audience. I would hate to follow that kid because the poor sap that had to follow that kid. Because, I mean, he gets up there and he talks about how awesome 3D printing is. I mean, he's absolutely blown away by the coolness of it, and he explains it and why it's so great, and just blows away the entire auditorium. He won everybody over. If you didn't think 3D printing was a big deal, watch this kid and how excited he is about it, and why he's excited about it, and you'll understand. So yeah. Google that. I'll try to find the link before we end the show tonight. But we are out of time, though. So, I mean, I guess I won't have the link until later in the show notes. So, anyway, it's been a pleasure, as always, PJ. I think Phil is returning next week. I hope that you can join us next week. You've been a blast, as always.
Oh, my pleasure. And this is so much fun. It's just, I love it. Thanks so much, Stephen.
Okay. All right, well, let's see. Our show, our music tonight is from Oliver Trolley, and he's singing Living My Life. And we will see you guys next week, same time. So, good night. Forget the pain, could you
in the Louvre, looking into colored lines and statues. Confused, cause I can't comprehend how the sword's like the pen. We haven't seen the gun in a while. Who knew the moon?